Yes, of 90.1 FM. Joki Burnaby, British Columbia, which stit hai.
Minority rule is a uniquely American problem. In no other established democracy can partisan minorities thwart electoral majorities as consistently or as consequentially as in the United States. So other democracies around the world have become more democratic over the last century, eliminating 18th and 19th century institutions that allowed minorities to systematically thwart majorities. Only the United States retained most of its pre-democratic institutions. We need to democratize American democracy.
That's Stephen Levitsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Stephen Levitsky on tyranny of the minority. The United States is moving toward a multiracial society, but that demographic development has sparked an authoritarian political backlash. Powerful forces like things just the way they are. Our political system makes the U.S. vulnerable to minority rule. Perhaps the most undemocratic mechanism enabling minority rule is the antiquated Electoral College. No other country has one. The Electoral College has given the presidency to a candidate that received fewer votes multiple times. Most recently, in 2016. Donald Trump was elected president, even though Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. It almost happened again in 2020, where a shift of a few thousand votes would have given the White House to Trump, even though Joe Biden got 7 million more votes. Our guest today is Stephen Levitsky. He's professor of government at Harvard. He's the co-author of How Democracies Die and Tyranny of the Minority. He spoke at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana in December 2023. And now, Stephen Levitsky.
The United States is experiencing what regimes scholars call democratic backsliding. All leading global democracy indices register a decline for the United States since 2016 or 17. Just to take one example, Freedom House has a global freedom index, which scores all countries annually from a low of zero, North Korea, to a high of 100. A decade ago, the United States received a score of 92 out of 100, which put the U.S. roughly on par with the U.K., Japan, Canada, Germany. Today, the U.S. score is 83. That's tied with Romania and below Argentina. Now, that may seem shocking to you, but when you have widespread efforts to make it harder to vote, when you have violent threats against election workers and elected officials, and when you have an attempt by an incumbent president to overturn an election, you fall to the point where Freedom House considers you less democratic than Argentina. Now, this wasn't supposed to happen. Political scientists have discovered two seemingly rock-solid facts about democracies. First of all, rich democracies never die. The wealthiest democracies ever to break down, Argentina and Hungary, both had a per capita GDP of about $17,000 in today's dollars. The U.S. is four times richer than that. Second seemingly rock-solid fact about democracies is that old democracies never die. No democracy over the age of 50 has ever broken down. Even if we date the birth of our democracy at 1965, when we achieved full suffrage, U.S. democracy was over 50 when Donald Trump was elected. So we ought to be safe, but we're not. And we argue that the United States is undergoing an unprecedented transition, an historic transition, a transition to a multiracial democracy in which a previously dominant group loses its dominant status. That, we argue, has triggered an authoritarian reaction among a minority of Americans. But that's only part of the story. Our Constitution, unfortunately, is exacerbating the problem by empowering that authoritarian minority. All right, to begin with, the United States is becoming a truly multiracial democracy. The U.S., as you all know, has become much more diverse and much more racially egalitarian over the last 60 years. The number of Black and Latino members of Congress has more than quadrupled since my bar mitzvah. I'm not that old. From 28 in 1980 to 114 today. The number of Latino members of Congress has increased from 9 to 55. The number of African Americans in Congress has increased from 19 to 60. For the first time in history, the percentage of African Americans in Congress, or the percentage of Congress that is African American, is now equal to the percentage of the overall population that is African American. In 1965, all 9 Supreme Court justices were white men. Today, 4 out of 9 are white men. Only 6 of 9 are white. Public opinion has also changed dramatically in the last half century. For the first time in the history of the Republic, a majority of Americans now embrace the core principles of multiracial democracy: ethnic diversity and racial equality. Some examples. In 1980, a majority of Americans opposed laws to ban discrimination in home sales. Today, 80% of Americans support laws banning discrimination in home sales. In the 1990s, most Americans consistently opposed affirmative action. Today, more than 60% of Americans tell Gallup they support affirmative action and greater workplace diversity. More than 60% of Americans now consistently agree with the statement that the growing diversity of our society makes America a better place to live. And a recent poll, I think from last year, found that more than 60% of Americans think our schools should teach kids about America's history of racism, even if it makes kids uncomfortable. This is a big deal. For the first time in history, America has a multiracial democratic majority. But our transition to multiracial democracy confronts 2 major challenges. I want to talk about these today. First, an authoritarian reaction, and second, a constitution that is amplifying that reaction. I want to take each of those points in turn. First of all, most fundamentally, United States democracy is in crisis today because one of our 2 major parties is no longer committed to playing by democratic rules of the game. Political parties that are committed to democracy, what the great political scientist Juan Linz called loyal Democrats, small d Democrats, loyal Democrats, parties that are committed to democracy must do 3 things, and this is taken from Linz. They must unambiguously accept the results of elections, win or lose. They must unambiguously reject the use of violence. And they must break completely with anti-democratic extremists. First 2 are pretty straightforward, so I want to develop the 3rd point, breaking with anti-democratic extremists. Single leaders, as powerful, as demagogic as they may seem, cannot kill a democracy on their own. They need accomplices among mainstream politicians. These are what Linz called semi-loyal Democrats. Again, small d Democrats. Semi-loyal Democrats can be hard to identify in a crowd. They look, they talk like regular politicians. The real litmus test, the way to distinguish a semi-loyal Democrat from a committed Democrat, is how they respond to the emergence of anti-democratic extremists in their own camp, on their own flank. When anti-democratic forces emerge on their own flank, loyal Democrats do 4 things. They publicly and unambiguously condemn anti-democratic behavior, even if it's done by their allies. They expel anti-democratic extremists from their ranks. They refuse to, say, nominate them for public office or support their candidacies. They cease all activities, both private and public, with groups that engage in anti-democratic behavior. And crucially, they join forces, or they're willing to join forces, with pro-democratic rivals from across the political and ideological spectrum to isolate and defeat anti-democratic extremists. This is Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. Semi-loyal Democrats do none of these things. Rather than publicly repudiate anti-democratic behavior on their own flank, they downplay that behavior. They justify it through whataboutism or simply remain silent. Rather than expelling anti-democratic extremists, semi-loyalists tolerate them, accommodate them, sometimes even nominate them. And crucially, semi-loyalists refuse to work with ideological rivals to defeat anti-democratic extremists, even when democracy is on the line. In other words, they choose their anti-democratic allies over their pro-democratic rivals. Now, semi-loyalists may appear relatively benign. These guys aren't actively trying to kill democracy. They're just regular politicians trying to get ahead, trying to, say, become House Speaker, or regain a Senate majority, maybe stave off a primary challenge, avoid the wrath of the base. But history tells us that semi-loyal behavior inevitably strengthens anti-democratic forces. So when mainstream politicians tolerate or condone anti-democratic extremists, it normalizes them. Mainstream media outlets start to interview them like any other politician. Donors who once shunned them decide that it's okay to contribute to their campaigns. Leading consultants and pollsters start to return their phone calls. And politicians who once kept a distance now decide it might be okay to join them. All of that empowers and emboldens anti-democratic forces. A clear lesson from democratic breakdowns in Europe in the 1930s and in Latin America in the 1960s and 70s is that when mainstream political parties of the center left or the center right start to flirt or cooperate with extremists, democracies get into trouble. Since 2020, the Republican Party has violated all three of these principles of loyal democratic behavior. Not only was Donald Trump the first U.S. president in history to try to overturn an election, but crucially, the bulk of the Republican Party went along with it. A group called the Republican Accountability Project, a group of conservative never-Trumpers, evaluated the public statements of all 261 members, Republican members of Congress, in the aftermath of the 2020 election to see whether they publicly cast doubt on the legitimacy of the 2020 election. 86% of them cast doubt on the election. This is crucial. Democracy requires that parties know how to lose. It's the cardinal rule of democracy. When a major party cannot accept defeat, democracy's in trouble. Republican politicians, or some of them, have also begun to flirt with political violence. They've embraced individuals, for example, who threatened or killed Black Lives Matter protesters. The McCloskeys, remember the McCloskeys? The St. Louis couple that drew their guns on unarmed protesters were given a prominent speaking role in the Republican convention. Marjorie Taylor Greene nominated Kyle Rittenhouse. Remember Kyle Rittenhouse? Nominated him for a congressional gold medal. And during the 2022 primary season, the New York Times found more than 100 Republican ads in which candidates brandished or fired guns. I can think of no other major political party in any established democracy in which candidates so openly embraced violence. But the most dangerous feature of the contemporary Republican Party is its pervasive semi-loyalty. Republican leaders knew that Donald Trump lost the 2020 election. And most of them in private were deeply troubled by his effort to overturn the results. But they enabled it anyway. They protected Trump by refusing to impeach and convict him. They blocked creation of an independent commission to investigate the January 6th insurrection. And nearly all of them say they will back Trump in 2024, even if he's convicted of trying to overturn an election. It does not have to be this way. Think about what happened recently in Brazil. Brazilians, as most of you know, elected a Trump-like figure, Jair Bolsonaro, in 2018. The U.S. media called him the Trump of the tropics. Bolsonaro governed a lot like Trump. He governed pretty badly. And like Trump, he narrowly lost his re-election bid in 2022. And like Trump, he tried to overturn the results. But his own political allies refused to go along with it. All major right-wing politicians in Brazil publicly recognized the opposition candidate Lula's victory on election night. The president of Congress, all the leading governors in the country recognized the results of the election. In other words, the McConnells, the McCarthys, the DeSantises of Brazil, all of them unambiguously accepted the results of the elections on election night. Brazil had a January 6th-like event on January 8th, 2023, protesters stormed the Congress, the Supreme Court building, the presidential palace. But the Brazilian right uniformly condemned the insurrection. Nobody downplayed it. Nobody condoned it. Nobody defended it. In fact, right-wing politicians in Brazil pushed for a congressional investigation into the events of January 8th. And finally, whereas Republicans plan to back Trump even if he's convicted of trying to overturn an election, the Brazilian courts barred Bolsonaro from running for the next 8 years, and conservative politicians have accepted that. They have not responded by attacking the legitimacy of the judicial system in Brazil. Bolsonaro is now an increasingly marginal figure in Brazilian politics. So there was another path. Republican leaders simply didn't pursue it. Now, to be clear, I am not saying that all Republicans are authoritarian. Many, many, in fact, millions of Republicans across the country are committed to democracy. But a failure to unambiguously accept election results, a flirtation with violence, and support for an openly authoritarian candidate are all clear signs of a political party that is no longer committed or fully committed to democratic rules of the game. So why is this happening? Why would an established political party like the Republicans, a party that's been competing peacefully in elections for more than 150 years, turn away from democracy? Again, in democracies, parties have to be able to live with losing. For parties to live with losing, for parties to tolerate losing, they have to believe that that losing will not bring ruinous consequences. When parties or their supporters perceive losing to pose an existential threat, they tend to radicalize. They tend to try to win at any cost. In other words, we argue that it is an outsized fear of losing that leads parties to turn away from democracy. Think about the Southern Democrats after the Civil War. This is if anyone accuses me of not being bipartisan, I'm going to rag on the Democrats. Reconstruction was this country's first experiment with multiracial democracy. It brought immediate and widespread black enfranchisement. African Americans were an outright majority or a near majority in most Southern states, most post-Confederate states. So their enfranchisement terrified Southern Democrats and their supporters. Not only did black suffrage threaten the Southern Democrats' electoral dominance, it threatened to overturn the entire racial order in the South. And for many Southern whites, that felt like an existential threat. So the Democrats abandoned any pretense of democracy. As one North Carolina Democrat put it, we cannot outnumber the Negroes. And so we must either out-cheat, out-count, or out-shoot them. And that's what they did. The Democrats used a combination of violent terrorism and election fraud to seize power across the South. They then entrenched themselves in power by using poll taxes, literacy tests, and other measures to wipe out African-American voting rights. Unwilling to lose, Southern Democrats stripped the right to vote from nearly half the population, ushering in nearly a century of authoritarian rule in the U.S. South. We fear that something similar, or at least parallel, is happening to the Republican Party today. The Republicans are a party of a majority ethnic group, white Christians, whose electoral and social dominance began to be threatened in the early 21st century. And the origins of that dynamic lie in the Civil Rights Revolution of the 1950s and the 1960s. That, the Civil Rights Revolution, was America's second experiment with multiracial democracy. When the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964, the Republicans were very clearly a minority party. They had been since the New Deal. But the Democrats' embrace of civil rights over the course of the 1960s and 70s alienated many of their racially conservative white voters. And that was especially true in the South, where the vast majority of white voters were Democrats. That fact, the alienation of many white racially conservative voters, created a political opportunity for the Republicans. So beginning with Goldwater, continuing with Nixon and with Reagan, the Republicans pretty systematically for about 20 years appealed to white resentments. And that strategy worked pretty well. Southern whites, over the course of 30 or 40 years, went from being overwhelmingly Democrats to being overwhelmingly Republicans. And the Republicans, over the course of the latter part of the 20th century, established themselves quite effectively as the party of self-identified white Christians. They've won the white vote in every presidential election since 1968. Because 80% of Americans self-identified as white and Christian in the 1970s and 80s, the Republicans achieved quite a bit of electoral success with this strategy. They ceased to be a minority party. In fact, the Republicans won every single presidential election between 1968 and 1988, except for the Watergate election of 1976. But the strategy eventually ran into trouble, because while the Republicans were becoming America's white Christian party, America was becoming less white and less Christian. The percentage of Americans who identified as white and Christian fell from 80% in 1976 to 43% in 2016. That had a couple of implications for the Republicans. First of all, it posed an electoral challenge. A reliance on white Christian votes made it hard, not impossible, but made it harder for the Republicans to win national majorities in the 21st century. In fact, the Republican Party has not won the popular vote since 2004. In 1980, Ronald Reagan won 55% of the white vote, translated that into a landslide election victory. 32 years later, 2012, Mitt Romney won a whopping 59% of the white vote, still lost. When Republicans realized they were winning the white vote but losing the American vote, they started to panic. And that's when we saw the first, at least in the recent era, state-level efforts to make it harder for people to register and vote, 2011, 12, 13. But the problem went way beyond just losing elections. For a part of the Republican base, the rise of multiracial democracy felt like an existential threat, because white Christians were not just any group. They were historically a dominant group. They sat atop all of the country's social hierarchies, right? For two centuries, every single president, every vice president, every House Speaker, every Senate Majority Leader, every Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, every Federal Reserve Chair, every Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was a white man. All the way through my bar mitzvah, every single governor, every single Fortune 500 CEO, every flippin' Miss America was white. All of that is now ending rapidly, relentlessly, right before our eyes. We see it in the quadrupling in the number of Black and Latino members of Congress since the 1980s. We see it in the growing presence of non-white and multiracial families on our TV screens and ads and movies. We see it in mounting societal pushback against acts of racism. Think of the Black Lives Matter protests. And we see it in challenges in classrooms, in newsrooms, to historical narratives that downplay or ignore America's racist past. We are witnessing in our lifetimes an unprecedented assault on this country's racial hierarchies. But when your group is on top of the hierarchy, challenges to that hierarchy can feel threatening. Losing one's dominant social status can generate feelings of loss, of resentment. It can feel like an existential threat. Many Trump voters, not all, many Trump voters feel like they're losing their country. They feel like the country they grew up in is being taken away from them. And that sense of loss has pushed many rank-and-file Republicans toward extremism. In a survey taken 2 years ago, 56% of Republicans agreed with the statement that the traditional American way of life is disappearing so fast that we may have to use force to save it. 56%. Now, the Republicans' radicalization would pose much less of a threat if the United States were like other democracies, where electoral majorities govern. In just about every Western democracy, there are 20, 25, maybe 30% of voters who sympathize with what we call far-right positions. But in no other established democracy has that 25 or 30% translated into so much political power. Again, Trump and MAGA have never, not for a day, represented a majority of Americans. Surveys show that majorities of Americans, again, embrace the principles of multiracial democracy. America now has a multiracial democratic majority. But that majority has hurled itself against some of the world's most powerful counter-majoritarian institutions. Now, let me be clear. Counter-majoritarian institutions are a mouthful. They are also essential to democracy. Modern democracy requires the protection of minority rights. Not everything can or should be up for grabs in an election. As Justice Robert Jackson famously put it, some domains must be placed beyond the reach of majorities. I want to suggest that two domains in particular absolutely must be placed beyond the realm or the reach of majorities. The first is civil rights. Civil liberties like the right to vote, free speech, freedom of association, assembly, freedom of conscience must be protected from the whims of the majority. Pretty obvious. A second domain that must be beyond the reach of majorities is the democratic process itself. Elected governments can't be able to use popular or parliamentary majorities to entrench themselves in power. For example, by changing the rules of the game to undermine competition or weaken their opponents. That's the kind of tyranny of the majority that we saw in Chavez's Venezuela, with Orban in Hungary, and with Netanyahu's judicial reform in Israel. So we need to have, every democracy must have mechanisms to protect the democratic system from majorities that would subvert it. So civil liberties and the right to fair competition are essential minority rights. They are rights that require counter-majoritarian institutions. So institutions like the U.S. Bill of Rights, an independent judiciary with some review power, and relatively high barriers to constitutional reform, these are what I would call essential counter-majoritarian institutions. But not all counter-majoritarian institutions are essential to democracy. In fact, some of them subvert democracy. So just as some domains must be placed beyond the reach of majorities, other domains, I would argue, must remain within the reach of majorities. And let me just mention two. One of them is elections. Those with more votes should prevail over those with fewer votes in determining who holds political office. To my knowledge, no theory of liberal democracy justifies any other outcome. A second domain that ought to remain within the realm of majorities is legislation. Those who win elections should govern. Partisan minorities should not be able to permanently veto legislation that's backed by parliamentary majorities, provided that legislation doesn't violate basic rights. Institutions that prevent electoral majorities from winning or that prevent parliamentary majorities from governing are not essential to democracy. In fact, they are antithetical to democracy. The U.S., it turns out, has an unusual number of these undemocratic institutions. The Electoral College, which allows losers of the popular vote to win the presidency. A severely malapportioned Senate that provides equal representation to all states, regardless of their population. The Senate filibuster, which is not part of the Constitution, but allows a partisan minority to permanently block legislation backed by a majority. And of course, a powerful Supreme Court with lifetime tenure for justices, which allows justices appointed in one generation to thwart majorities for generations to come.
You're listening to Stephen Levitsky, Tyranny of the Minority. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Now, undemocratic counter-majoritarian institutions are often a product of transitional political pacts, pacts in which powerful authoritarian forces demand special protections in exchange for giving up power. We saw this, for example, in post-Pinochet Chile. We saw it with the Polish communists in 1989. We saw it with whites in South Africa. We see it with the military in contemporary Thailand. In all these cases, authoritarian forces demanded extra protection, a sort of leg up in exchange for giving up power. Now, we don't usually think of the United States, of our counter-majoritarian institutions, in these ways, right? We usually think of our counter-majoritarian institutions as a product of far-sighted design. We think of it as part of a carefully crafted blueprint for checks and balances. That, I want to suggest, is in large part a myth. The framers of the U.S. Constitution were very smart folks, but they weren't out there trying to design the perfect republic. they were trying to hold the Union together and prevent a descent into civil war or foreign military intervention. And to do that, to prevent a breakup of the Union and a